Thomas v. Kiewit Construction Company. Mr. Harris, whenever you're ready.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Jim Harris and I'm here representing Robert Thomas in this case. The trial court's initial error of law in rejecting the plaintiff's complaint alleging premises liability theory of recovery led to a cascade of at least three other errors of law, each of which standing alone or in conjunction constitute reversible error. First address the principal party presentation, which really is that plaintiff is the master of his own complaint. The pleadings frame the issues upon which a cause is to be tried, and in fact, a case is limited to those issues which are pleaded. In this case, the court at the directed verdict hearing determined that this case was not a premises liability case, stating this is especially not premises liability, and he proceeded to decide the matter based on a finding that plaintiff failed to comply with the rules involving vicarious liability for the negligence of subcontractors.
Mr. Harris, does Nebraska have a premises liability case that deals with a contractor and the employee of an independent
Absolutely.
Contractor?
Absolutely. The first one was the 1981 case of Sullivan versus George Hormel and Company. And I think that one was argued to the court below.
Did the court use the proposition of law, the one about the contractor's not liable to employees of the independent contractor unless one of these four things happens?
Absolutely not.
Because that's
there's no vicarious liability. There's right? no allegation that any subcontractor was negligent.
So that proposition of law and its four exclusions, if I understand your argument correctly, isn't even applicable in this case.
It convinced the court, and it was argued strenuously by defense counsel, but it has no applicability here.
Because you're not alleging vicarious liability. You're alleging independent, active negligence.
Direct against Kiewit, the general contractor.
Okay.
And in fact...
I sidetracked you. You said no, Sullivan versus Hormel, and then you were going to say something.
Well, let me finish the thought there, because in fact, following along with that, in adopting the court's conclusion in this regard and what the defendant is trying to advance, would completely insulate and protect general contractors from their own negligence in all construction projects. No matter what direct negligence the general contractor performed, they wouldn't be responsible to any of the workers on any of the job sites. And I think that would be not only absurd, but be a violation of a public policy. And it may also be unconstitutional. I don't know how we even get there, because general contractors do have the duty to maintain a safe place to work. And this ruling basically eradicates that. So, and again, not only was there no allegation of vicarious negligence here, but defendant's 30B6 witness denied that there was any negligence. The AWS, the employer's representative, testified they weren't negligent in any way, nor were either any of his employees. Plaintiff doesn't allege it. There's just no facts to support that, but yet we were dismissed based on this vicarious liability law, which unfortunately my name probably appears in four or five of those cases. I know that law very well. Defendants argue that we're trying to create a novel theory of liability, and I don't see anything novel in premises liability, and founded upon this Hormel case, Sullivan versus Hormel. We followed that framework to a T. So amending the party's pleading over objection, it constitutes a clear abuse of discretion. I cited Justice Scalia in a U.S. Supreme Court case. Nebraska likewise holds that in a Nebraska case, the courts are supposed to be neutral arbiters. They're not supposed to intervene and say, well, you should have pled it this way, or... And in this case, we had two versions of facts of the burden of proof in our pretrial statements, which supersede the pleadings. And so plaintiff preserved his issues that says, no, this is how we pled it. This is what we meant. We have to live and die by this standard. And defense incorporated theirs separately, and the court adopted the defense. It would be just like plaintiff rewriting the defendant's answer, saying, well, they allege contributory negligence, but I really don't want that in this case. So the parties are responsible for advancing the facts and arguments, entitled them to relief, and the other side can't, nor the court can unilaterally change the theory of recovery. So that's number one. And I talked about the cascade. One of them, we talked a little bit about being directly negligent. The court argued that placement of the sand and failure to remove it did not constitute a condition on the land. And that conclusion is contrary to established law. And again, referring to the Sullivan case where there was a fall on ice and debris at a construction site.
Do you have any authority that sand is a dangerous condition when it's used as a remedial measure on ice?
Well, sand used as a remedial measure on ice, there is no testimony that it is. Matter of fact, it is a very safe method. But there was an abundance of testimony at trial that a sand left on this particular surface is extremely slippery. Perry Schaefer, a co-worker, iron worker, testified it was like walking on BBs on ice, on glass. And our expert witness showed tribometer readings and then demonstrated that process to the jury. And in fact, on page 18, you'll see the results of that. And the defendant, the 30B6 witness, said that this surface was, the steel troweled concrete was slippery when wet. But in fact, the testing showed that it was in the safe zone where testing the exact sand on this exact type of surface was akin to ice, and that's slippery. So it wasn't the putting down the sand that was negligent. That's a safe and proper thing to do, and everybody concurs. But there was no plan for when to put down the sand, and there equally was no plan when to pick it up. And the defendant's 30B6 witness admits that it's debris. And debris is what has to be cleaned in order to have safe walkways.
The sand was placed up there. People knew it was up there, and it was available for workers to spread at their discretion, as I recall. Is that
That's
correct?
What Keywood's testimony was. But AWS's foreman and the iron worker said that they never put down sand on any job, including this one, and that the Keywood laborers were the ones that picked it up. And most importantly, that spread it on all the surfaces. But most importantly, when there was water or puddles from the melting ice in the middle of the winter, Kiewit laborers would come in and either squeegee or suction off the puddles of water because it was slippery. On this event, afterwards on page 16, you'll find a contemporaneous report where the general contractor was called, told that the sand was need to be picked up, and it says that there's no more ice, that it was dry, and the general contractor admits that they did in fact come in, and that follows the safety rule of that's stated by the 30B6 witness that the person responsible for making the mess is responsible for cleaning up the mess.
So was that entry is related to your client's injury, is that right, or is that a different?
No, it's exactly the place that he had only one single path that they could follow in order to move the large...
Right, but was the entry made because of your client's fall?
Exactly. As a matter of fact, it references it.
Okay.
If you read it on the left-hand side, it references his fall.
Okay. So if we're looking at a premises liability theory, which, you know, the supermarket comes to mind, there's a grape on the ground, somebody steps on it, or whatever... Don't we need some type of notice to the contractor that the dangerous condition exists and needs to be cleaned up? Because when they put the sand down, I think everybody agrees it's a good idea. I mean, it's a good way to cover up the ice.
Makes it safe to walk.
Makes it safe to walk. So at some point, don't they have to be told or notified that it's now a danger and ask to clean it up before they're
liable? Exactly,
and
the court addressed that. He says even if they had possession and control of the premises, I don't think they could satisfy that they have actual constructive knowledge. But the answer to that is very clear, because premises liability law says the notice requirement does not apply when the defendant created the condition.
But it wasn't a dangerous condition that they created, because at that time they were putting it on ice, which wasn't a dangerous condition. It helped them walk. It became a dangerous condition once the ice melted, if I'm understanding correctly.
Once the ice melted, it was dry. But yes, but they created the condition. They knew the sand was down, and they should have known that sand left on this surface, just like any other debris left on that surface, is slippery. And so that one's, my goodness, time flies.
How time flies.
When you're having fun. I hope I answered that question for you, but I think the law is abundantly clear that the notice requirement is not, doesn't apply where they create the condition.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Ketchum.
May it please the court. I'm Dan Ketchum here for Kiewit Building Group. I'm going to start, if it's okay with you, on the question of did the court apply the right law. There's two cases where Nebraska courts have discussed the law in this area. One of them that I didn't fully appreciate until preparing for argument is CB versus Lancaster County School District. 280 Neb 205.
Which this, is not a construction
case. It's not a construction case, but it there is some dicta in there where it discusses the history of how the restatement has taken this fact pattern out of general duty analysis under both the restatement second and third. So I think it's helpful for the court to review that. Under the restatement third, cases where a subcontractor's employee is injured are specifically accepted from the general duty argument that he's arguing for under like King's Gate that the court recently adopted. And it discusses that and a little bit of the history of how Parrish versus OPPD was the first Nebraska case. And then as we know, that was later distinguished by Gaten versus Walmart, which is the case in this area. And that's the second case. And that discusses at length the difference between the restatement third and the restatement second. What Mr. Harris is trying to do is argue for a restatement third approach while completely ignoring that the actual restatement third treats injuries to subcontractors differently and completely ignoring that the Nebraska Supreme Court in Gaten specifically said we're not following the restatement third in these subcontractor injury cases. We're following the old restatement second, section 416.
Was Gaten a vicarious liability case, though? That was the case where the guy drops through the Walmart off the roof?
Right.
And the allegations against the general contractor, were those based on vicarious liability of the negligence of the sub?
Well, there's an analysis. There's four exceptions to the general rule that...
Right, but doesn't the general rule, in the body of the general rule, before you get to the exceptions, doesn't that talk about vicarious liability?
The rationale for the treating it differently in the restatement is because there is vicarious liability, correct.
But
and
Mr.
the Nebraska
Harris
Supreme Court said they're not following that vicarious liability exception to the third restatement. That's why they prefer their approach under the second restatement.
But as I understand Mr. Harris's argument, he's arguing this isn't vicarious liability. We're not trying to hold Kiewit liable for the negligence of a subcontractor. We're trying to hold Kiewit negligent for their own negligence.
Right. And to the extent and to the extent that he's trying to do that, it's not a premises liability case, first of all, because we're not the owner and we're not in possession or control of the 12th floor. Situation is without dispute that Architectural Wall Systems was responsible for the work they were doing that day. They were staging their construction materials, probably the most common thing on any construction project,
but
your materials.
But didn't the judge then have to deal with that issue? If you're saying that they were unable to establish that your client had control,
then the premise liability that they are alleging would not apply, and you win. But that's not what happened, at least the way I understand.
Well, the court didn't really set forth a published opinion setting forth what their reasoning was, and that's part of the difficulty.
But it made it, it took it from a premise liability case to a vicarious liability case, didn't it?
I don't think there is such a distinction. If you look at the other cases, this court just decided Ashoff this spring, which is similar too. I think that's the bulldozer at the lake. And you know, again, the allegation was that the general was responsible for this premises. The analysis under Gayton, one of the exceptions is where the general, there's four exceptions, is in control of the premises under Gayton. So I think that the proper way to handle any injuries to a subcontractor is Gayton. The general rule is there's no liability, but the second of the four exceptions is control of the premises. And I think the court heard that evidence and heard those arguments. And in trying to decide if there's a duty, I think the really fatal thing to the plaintiffs was more the evidence on the facts. There was no evidence that sand was a hazard. It's not an OSHA violation. There were no OSHA violations. There was no OSHA testimony. There was no testimony as to an industry standard or practice regarding sand. The evidence was that Kiewit and AWS and all these subs had to do a hazard analysis for risk specific to that job. So in this instance, what came through loud and clear in that hazard analysis is we're building a building in February open to the weather. It's icy. This is dangerous. People are complaining of ice. So Kiewit was very proactive. They hired extra people. They suctioned water up so it couldn't form ice. They provided sand. They sanded the main walk areas. This accident did not occur in the main walk area. The evidence is that the subs were responsible for the other walk areas. Sand was put down as something that was beneficial, something plaintiff's expert testified to. There's no standard that you have to remove the sand in any certain time frame or manner. In fact, there was no testimony of one complaint of the sand being a dangerous condition, workers complaining about it. The plaintiff himself said he'd walked over this over 20 times, didn't consider it to be hazardous. His coworkers didn't consider it to be hazardous. After the fall, they looked at it, and AWS didn't even clean it up because they didn't consider it to be hazardous. They were told by Kiewit, you created the mess, you need to pick it up, and that's what happened afterwards. But the point is, there was either no industry standard or job-specific report making this a dangerous condition for which there would be any duty to pull it up. In fact, it was improving safety as intended.
So I'm stuck. I'm still stuck in Gayton. The court set forth the general rule.
Yes.
Which is, one who employs an independent contractor is not liable for physical harm caused to another by the acts or omissions of the contractor or its servants. And then case law gives us four exceptions. But from reading Mr. Harris's brief, he's not arguing that Kiewit is liable to his client because of the negligence of the contractor.
Right.
So why are we even applying that?
Well,
is that because that's the only thing that can apply in contractor cases?
I think that's because both restatements have stepped in and said that we're going to define, because these are such unique situations. Let's look at that 12th floor. Kiewit's not there. Mm-hmm. There are 6 to 8 contractors doing different things. It's changing constantly, the condition, you know, as people are moving and everything. And so I think because of that, it takes it completely out of the normal landowner thing, where landowner presumably knows his land better than an entrant. And, you know, you get into the old law, invitees and licensees and latent defects, and that's kind of been changed to a reasonable standard. But here, Kiewit doesn't have better knowledge of what the conditions are at the precise time of that accident. They're not even there. So to make them liable for anybody that slips and falls on the premises essentially makes them an insurer. I mean, AWS is responsible for doing that work, supervising their employees, supervising their safety. Plaintiff himself was responsible for walking his route and making sure it was safe and taking proactive steps to make sure it was safe each morning before he worked. That wasn't Kiewit's obligation. That was plaintiff's and AWS's. So in looking at the cases like that and Ashoff, they do involve injuries to the subcontractor's employee. I know how that's worded, but there is that little bit of disconnect in how that rule is worded, and then you look at the fact patterns of the cases, and they're similar to this one.
So would you agree that Sullivan versus Hormel is different in that it's a direct liability case as opposed to vicarious like Gaetan is?
I would say it's an old, outdated case, pre-Parrish, outdated. We have the restatement second and third, and Nebraska's adopted the second. Thank you.
Thank you. No, nope. Thanks.
I think we took Mr. Harris over his time, did we not? Okay. Case is submitted. Thank you, gentlemen.